This free program is paid for by the listener members of KPFT Houston. If you're not already a member, think about joining with us to help keep free speech alive.
I guess we're not doing the usual go-around. Anyway, on tonight's program, David Elliott joins us from Washington, D.C. with his Inside the Beltway and Beyond report. With the Indiana and North Carolina caucuses tomorrow, I'm sure David will have a lot to talk about. In celebration of Cinco de Mayo, we invited members of the Houston Hispanic GLBT community to share about their activities and events. Abel Rodriguez of GAIO will join us. Nachos and margaritas all around. Brian Erickson talks with Daddy Bob, Miss Christie, and Sir Robert. Daddy Bob, Miss Christie, and Sir Robert, who is the president of the National Leather Association Houston chapter. And we'll be talking about the leather lifestyle. It isn't just for queers. And then, in our final segment of the evening, the Vagina Monologues with a unique twist. Joe Watts talks about his production of the Vagina Monologues celebrating its 10th anniversary with Brian Levinka, with a taste of a performance from the play by our very own Jennifer Renee. All that and more coming up on Queer Voices. And we're waiting to make sure we have David Elliott on the line. I think he is just seconds away. I'm waiting for the... Hey, David? David, Earth to David. No.
Well, hello.
Oh, hello. Yes, David Elliott.
Well, hello, Deb. How are you?
I'm lovely. We were having a little bit of technical, things going on. I wasn't really sure where we were. But Jack and I are in the studio, and we're thinking that maybe you might be talking about Indiana and North Carolina tonight.
Or Guam.
I don't know. That's just our guess.
Well, I actually have some personal news I want to bring
Good.
You all tonight.
Good.
But I was thinking maybe I'd do that a little bit later on. In the next 15 minutes, because my job first and foremost is to bring you the political news.
Right.
And you're right. Deb, Jack, it seems like month after month after month after month, I come on your radio show, and I expect that we will have a Democratic nominee for president. And we didn't have one in February. When I came on, we didn't have one in March. When I came on, we didn't have one in April. When I came on, and tonight it's May 5th, and we still don't have a Democratic presidential nominee. And I don't know, as a political pundit, I have to tell you it's driving me crazy, but we have to let the process play out. And Deb is right. We have lots of political news, actually, to talk about tonight. But first and foremost, tomorrow morning, just about 8 hours or so from now, voters in Indiana and North Carolina will be heading to the polls. Indiana has 47 delegates at stake. North Carolina has 77 delegates at stake. I'm going to give you my prediction. It's not going to be over after tomorrow.
Yay!
My prediction is that Barack Obama is going to win North Carolina by approximately 10 percentage points, 55% to 45%. Hillary Clinton is going to win Indiana by approximately 5 percentage points, 52.5% to 47.5%. I do not see a possibility of a sweep by either candidate. In other words, I do not see a possibility of Hillary Clinton winning North Carolina, and despite the fact that Indiana polls are all over the place, I do not see a possibility of Barack Obama winning Indiana. I really think it's going to be a split.
So we always know how accurate David's predictions are, so just whatever the opposite of what he said, that's probably what's going to happen. No, I'm kidding you, David.
Well, no, actually, Deb, one of the women who participates frequently on this show, Joan Devlin,
yes,
once pointed out to me that I need to play like the opposite game. But here's what's really, really, really strange. I only get it wrong when I go on your show and make predictions, which is 1 week out of the month. Any other time that I'm predicting elections, I get it right.
So maybe you should secretly email us those so that we'll know.
Right.
So what is some of the background of how you have come to this prediction? What are you looking at? What polls? What, you know?
Well,
you just get anybody and everybody's comment on the subject, everything from blogs to just the way headlines are written to, you know, four or five different polls from, you know, different news organizations as well as independent polling.
Well, you know, I've spent the last 4 days bleary-eyed looking at so much data and so many polls, and there's one really troubling thing that has emerged that I have to tell you all about. And I think it's, I don't think it's a long-term problem. I think it's a short-term problem. We right now have a problem in the Democratic Party when it comes to stratification. And what I mean by that is you can almost look at a demographic group and declare with certainty how they're going to vote in the election. Blacks overwhelmingly, we're talking about 90% to 10%, are going with Barack Obama. Upper income voters, people making over $40,000 a year in income, are going with Barack Obama. Men, by about 10 points, are going with Barack Obama. Women, by about 15 points, are going with Hillary Clinton. Blue collar, white voters who are non-degreed and making $30,000 or less, strongly by like 30 percentage points, are going with Hillary Clinton. And it's kind of, frankly, troubling.
Yeah.
That a Democratic Party, a party that prides itself on diversity, is this stratified. And we have got to look at ways to come together and unify once this thing is decided. And part of the problem, to be frank, is that Obama and Clinton are not very far apart on the issues. If they were far apart on the issues, that would be one thing. But the fact that they're not makes this almost like a high school presidential election contest. You know, and I remember, you know, in high school when we had candidates running for president, you never ever voted on the basis of the issues. You made it a popularity contest. Which person was your friend? You know, which person was in the clique that you hung out with?
Yes, and a really good movie to watch is called Election, the one with Reese Witherspoon and
Matthew Broderick.
Matthew Broderick, yes.
It's hysterical.
Well, only on Queer Voices would we go from a discussion of, you know, the political race to a discussion of the movie Elections. But y'all are totally right.
Yeah. Well, but don't you think, David, that in the long run that unification will take place, that once we do have a nominee, I mean, there's not an option.
Well, Deb, you're totally right. You're totally right. Voter registration is off the charts. A lot more Democrats are registering to vote than Republicans. We had a special election on Saturday in a Republican congressional district around Baton Rouge, Louisiana, where Republicans on average win by 7 percentage points, and the Democratic candidate won by 3. We've got a brand new poll out today in Texas, Rasmussen is the name of the pollster, where an extremely well-known U.S. Senate incumbent, Republican John Cornyn, is up only by 4 points, 47
wow.
to 43
wow.
percentage against his Democratic challenger, Rick Noriega.
That's incredible.
Which is endorsed by the Houston Gay, Lesbian, Bisexual, Transgender Political Caucus.
Important to know.
Just as an aside there, you know. That's pretty amazing that kind of change is taking place, and I've been hearing reports of elsewhere in the country that there seems to be this surge, although there has been some talk that black voters may not come out in the Democratic Party if Obama is not the nominee.
Well, it depends how that shakes out. If Obama, you know, goes into the summer and he's got a majority of pledged delegates, and he's got a majority of the popular vote, and he has a majority of superdelegates, which he will have in about 2 weeks, and then somehow he was denied the nomination, then there would be some anger. But if you play all those things out, there's no way that could happen. If the majority of superdelegates back him, he's going to get the nomination. Look, folks, it's really important to go back to 1984 when Walter Mondale and Gary Hart were competing for the Democratic nomination. Mondale, after every single primary was completed, Mondale did not have a majority of the delegates. But he had a 300-400 delegate lead over Gary Hart, right? The superdelegates had a meeting, and, you know, all of a sudden, they came out for Mondale. You know, they recognized the will of the majority, and it was done. And something like that will be happening probably in late May. I don't even think that we're going to go into June with this. I really don't. I think this thing might be over in May. So we're not going to be facing with this doomsday scenario of, you know, one side or the other leaving the Democratic Party. Look, Obama supporters are not going to flee to McCain. Hillary Clinton supporters are not going to flee to McCain. We're having a spirited Democratic primary, a spirited contest. And it is actually at some point going to end, even though it didn't end in February and it didn't end in May.
Although somehow it doesn't seem like it is. Well, personally, I'd like for it not to be decided until after Texas has its primary. Its state convention the first weekend in June. Just because. What we're looking at with these decisions certainly will affect those down ballot candidates, such as the Cornyn Noriega. When all is said and done, and it's November, is it November 4th this year?
I believe it is.
Okay. For some reason, November 4th always sticks in my mind as Election Day, but I know it's not always November 4th. But this country, there's been a change, there's been a sea change. And the fact that we've had so many people register to vote, the fact that we've had such a intense campaigning and discussion, even though they get sidetracked sometimes, to me, that's much more the democratic process, much more what we want to see happening in this country than just the blindly following, like sheep, whoever, you know, whatever party says, you know. There's been more active participation, which is more than just the vote, and that's really important. Well, David, tell us your personal news.
Well, you know, I have to tell you, it's hard telling people this, but after 6.5 years, I am going to be leaving. Actually have left the place I've been working for, the National Coalition to Abolish the Death Penalty, and I have accepted a job as communications director for a group called U.S. Action. And U.S. Action, basically, they grew out of a group in the 1990s called Citizen Action.
Uh-huh.
And basically, the top issues I'm going to be working on will be U.S. out of Iraq, universal health care, tax equity, no tax breaks for the rich, support for public education, tax credits for people who are putting their kids through college, and that sort of thing. And, you know, there's some more to their agenda. But basically, and we're going to be doing some election work, too, some key U.S. Senate races, about 30 or 40 key U.S. House races, and presidential races in about 6 or 8 states.
And you'll still be able to come and join us on the first Monday of each month to talk about what's going on inside the Beltway and beyond, right?
Oh, absolutely. you're not getting rid of me so easily.
Okay, David Elliott, thank you for being with us on Queer Voices. And now we're going this way to News Wrap from This Way Out.
We had a coffee counter in the back, and which we had a pink pig, and everybody had to pay into the pig, or they should, when they had coffee. And it became a place for people to meet and talk and discuss issues. And that started in the first year and built slowly and built a fairly faithful clientele that it was kind of their home, their drop-off center. They'd come in once a day and check in. Me, whoa.
stop well short of marriage, Nepal gay activist Sunil Pant goes to Parliament, and how Canada's little sisters defied customs of the day. Those stories and more this week, now that you've discovered This Way Out.
I'm Tanya Kane Perry.
And I'm John Beaupre.
With News Wrap, a summary of some of the news in or affecting the lesbian and gay community for the week ending May 3rd, 2008. Australia's recent...
I want to say thank you, and mostly a great big thank you for all the support throughout the years. This is one of my favorite love songs. And I can't think of a better way to start a grand engagement.
Lesbian radio magazine. I'm Greg.
So lucky.
Australian queer couple.
But I should be in love with someone like you. No one makes me feel the way you do, the way you do. You're making my dreams come true. And so lovely. And I...
The week ending May 3rd, 2008. Australia's recently elected Labour Party government announced significant proposals this week to eliminate discrimination against same-gender couples in about 100 federal laws, mostly addressing monetary inequities. Under the changes, as part of the government's budget plan to be issued later this month, gay and lesbian couples in long-term relationships would be treated the same as their heterosexual married peers in several financial areas, though the announcement also stressed that marriage or civil unions were not part of the equation. Attorney General Robert McClelland said during an Australian Broadcasting Corporation radio interview that
removing discrimination, if you like, is the issue of significance to be addressed. Most certainly there will be a wide range of reforms in the areas of social security, taxation, superannuation. It is my belief that the vast majority of members and senators will agree that the time has long come for these discriminatory provisions to be removed.
Opposition Liberal Party leader Brendan Nelson offered his provisional cooperation.
Well, as a matter of principle, we believe that no Australian should pay a dollar more in tax or receive a dollar less in social security support by virtue of their sexuality. Whilst we will steadfastly oppose gay marriage, gay adoption and gay IVF, we will carefully scrutinise the proposals that are being put up by the government, and if they are affordable and reasonable, we will certainly be providing support to them.
Most queer activist groups celebrated the government's announcement, but also complained that the proposals don't go far enough. Rodney Croom of the Australian Coalition for Equality said in a press release that gay and lesbian Australians will not be fully equal until we are allowed the right to marry the partner of our choice.
Meanwhile, the federal government has been involved in a long-running dispute with the Australian Capital Territory, or ACT, over civil unions. The previous Liberal Party government of John Howard twice overruled a civil unions law passed by the ACT legislature, which the federal government has the power to do. The Labor government of Prime Minister Kevin Rudd is opposing the most recently proposed ACT legislation because it includes a ceremony which it claims makes civil unions too much akin to marriage, and therefore violates the Federal Marriage Act. The ACT government continues to assert that civil union ceremonies do not make them equivalent to marriage. Some Australian locales have already enacted civil union laws, such as in the Australian state of Tasmania, or some other form of legal recognition for same-gender couples. The state of New South Wales has reportedly delayed plans to introduce a domestic partner registry for same-gender couples because of the continuing dispute over the ACT proposal.
Elsewhere, Uruguay's first civil union finally took place in mid-April, more than 3 months after the first such law in Latin America creating them came into force. 38-year-old actor Adrián Figuera and 67-year-old theater director Juan Carlos Moretti tied the knot before a judge, family, and friends. They've been together 14 years. The law applies to two people, whatever their sex, identity, orientation, or sexual option may be, who maintain an emotional relationship of a sexual nature and an exclusive, singular, stable, and permanent character without being united in matrimony. Couples must have lived together for 5 years before they can take advantage of the law, which grants spousal rights in areas that include inheritance, property ownership, pensions, parenting, and health care.
In another first, the Himalayan nation of Nepal this week elected its first ever openly gay member of parliament. Sunil Pant, who leads the country's major queer advocacy group, Blue Diamond Society, won a seat representing the capital of Kathmandu as a member of the CPNU, one of several small communist parties. He was one of five openly LGBT people running for office in nationwide voting that swept the left into power. The election was critical to a pact between Maoists and mainstream parties that ended a decade-long civil war in Nepal and dethroned its king. CPNU leader Ganesh Shah told reporters that, "We are honored to send Pant as our representative to the Constituent Assembly," adding that, "We hope it will improve the lives of a people who are the most repressed in Nepal, disowned both by society and their own families." The country's Supreme Court ruled in December that the government must create new laws to protect LGBT rights and change current ones that discriminate. The government has thus far failed to act on the court's directive. In other election news this week, Brian Paddock, who as Deputy Assistant Police Commissioner of London's Metropolitan Police had been the highest-ranking openly gay police officer in the world, lost his bid to become its mayor. The Liberal Democrat came in third to Tory Boris Johnson, who unseated second-place pro-queer Labour incumbent Ken Livingstone. It remains to be seen what impact Johnson's election might have on LGBT people there.
The inclusion of LGBT people in the churches of two Christian denominations also made news this week. Delegates to the 2008 United Methodist Church General Conference meeting in Fort Worth, Texas, adopted a resolution offered by its legislative committee's minority that retains language in the denomination's Book of Discipline describing homosexual acts as incompatible with Christian teaching. They rejected the majority proposal to strike the incompatibility sentence and to acknowledge in the United Methodist Social Principles that church members disagree on homosexuality. Delegates also voted to retain language in the Book of Discipline that prohibits United Methodist ministers from conducting ceremonies that celebrate same-gender unions. Following the votes, a coalition of queer religious advocacy groups, including Soul Force, Affirmation, Reconciling Ministries Network, and Methodist Federation for Social Action, held a disappointed silent vigil as delegates were returning from a dinner break to the Fort Worth Convention Center. Delegates did, however, approve a resolution condemning homophobia and heterosexism, saying the church opposes all forms of violence or discrimination based on gender, gender identity, sexual practice, or sexual orientation.
And in a decision that openly lesbian minister Jane Spahr called separate but unequal, the General Assembly Permanent Judicial Commission of the Presbyterian Church, USA, this week overturned the censure she had received for performing same-gender marriages because, the ruling said, a same-sex ceremony is not and cannot be a marriage. It stressed that church officials who are authorized to perform marriages shall not state, imply, or represent a same-sex ceremony is a marriage. Spahr told reporters that, "The reason I'm not censured is because it's not being considered a marriage. It says again that we are less than. It goes against God. It is painful. It is still part of a system of oppression that labels people and promotes stereotyping and violence." Spahr recently retired after more than 30 years of performing hundreds of marriages, both same-gender and heterosexual, as a Presbyterian minister in Northern California's Marin County.
In other news, three residents of the island of Lesbos are suing a queer advocacy group over its name, the homosexual and lesbian community of Greece. They want a court to ban anyone except islanders and their descendants from using the word lesbian. Plaintiff Demetrius Lambro told the Associated Press that our geographical designation has been usurped by certain ladies who have no connection whatsoever with Lesbos and insults our identity. The plaintiffs say they targeted the LGBT group because it's the only officially registered group in the country to use the word lesbian in its name. They're arguing that iconic poet Sappho, who called the island home in the 6th century BC and thus lent its name to the term lesbian, never practiced same-gender love, and that such assertions over the centuries have been an affront. Sappho extensively celebrated female-female love with such verses as, "Her tongue will not move, a subtle fire burns under her skin. Her eyes see no longer, her ears ring, she breaks into a sweat, she trembles." Andrea Gilbert, a member of the queer group being sued, told the British website pinknews.com that the term lesbian, to define women who love women, exists in every dictionary of just about all UN member nations. The term is recognized universally. This would be hilariously funny, she said, if it wasn't so pathetic and so scary. The level of acceptance of same-gender love in Greece is among the lowest of European Union nations, comparable to that in Poland, Latvia, Lithuania, Bulgaria, Romania, and Cyprus. The lesbian lawsuit is scheduled to be heard in an Athens court in June.
And finally, according to a report in India's Hindustan Times, the first telephone hotline in China for lesbians. This is Queer Voices.
Cinco de Mayo. We have with us Abel Rodriguez of Gallo.
Buenas noches.
Yeah,
hola, amigo. And this is Brian Lavinco.
Oh, we're going to speak Spanish. And I got to say, gracias, mi amiga Linda Morales, for setting this whole thing up. Not setting the whole thing up, but I did say, hey Mo, or Elmo, as I like to call her. Who could we have on so that we could, you know, celebrate Cinco de Mayo and the spirit of the day? And she suggested Abel Rodriguez because he is the executive director of the organization. First of all, let's touch on what the heck is Cinco de Mayo besides the 5th of May?
The 5th of May, Cinco de Mayo, is a commemoration of the victory in the Battle of Puebla, which is against the Mexican army against the French.
The French?
Exactly.
There you go. Oh. So you learned a little history. And they were undermanned, but they won. It's kind of like the Alamo thing, you know.
Right.
although we were very bad with the Alamo. We think of, you know, we go, oh, the Alamo, but what were we doing? We were stealing the land of the Mexicans. Okay, anyway, that's besides the point.
So today is Cinco de Mayo, the 5th of May.
And it's become a celebration all over the world. For a lot of people, it doesn't really matter what it is, but it is a day to recognize the Hispanic community. Even though it was Mexico, I guess many Latin American, Central American countries still kind of recognize it, although you said earlier that it isn't as big of a day in Mexico than it is here.
I was going to say, I was in Philadelphia this weekend, and they have a huge like spread for all, you know, like outdoor parties, and you wouldn't think that being that far from Mexico that they would have a big event for that, but it is a national holiday, I think, here in the United States.
And in Kansas last year, it was Cinco de Mayo everywhere. I'm like, oh, okay. I felt at home. So Gallo, I know that it means rooster in Spanish.
That is correct.
So why do you have a group called Rooster?
Well, Gallo is an acronym for our organization's name, which is Gay and Lesbian Latin Organization, G-A-L-L-O. And, of course, the double L's are pronounced as a Y. And everyone is familiar with the rooster, but we put a little rainbow tail on there to signify that it is a gay organization.
Yeah, they're very cute, too, their little logo. And so is it a local organization or also state, national?
Actually, it's a local organization here in Houston. It was founded in August of 2005 by Christina Martinez and myself. We were concerned about the lack of representation and inclusion and the participation of Latino women and men in the GLBT community here in Houston. It started as a little bit of history. I can tell you that what began as an informal gathering now has become a diverse organization with many voices with one common goal, and that is building bridges and serving la comunidad.
Mm. Serving the community.
The community, exactly.
That's what one's easy to translate. And so there had been other organizations previously, spun off.
Exactly. It all started back in the early 80s with an organization called GLU, the Gay and Lesbian Hispanic Unidos. That was a very strong organization, but toward the end, there was little participation, and so that one died off. 6 years later, another organization evolved, and that was named the Gay and Lesbian Organized by Orgullo, Globo. That was short-lived, and out of that, Christina Martinez and I decided to come together and found an organization, and Gaia was born.
And that was what year?
2005.
Okay.
So we're still in our crawling stages.
Toddlers.
It seems like some gay organizations kind of evolve or kind of fade away over time, so it's important to kind of stay relevant and kind of bring people back together. And I know that Christina is involved with the Rainbow Pages.
Exactly.
So she's very active in the community.
She's very active in the community, and you had just mentioned, were we a local or national organization? We are a local organization, but we're involved nationally as well.
And how is that?
Well, we are involved with GLAAD, the Gay and Lesbian Alliance Against Defamation. We have worked with GLAAD in the past against Univision and television and radio stations that Univision owns, because they stereotype and discriminate against gay and lesbian Latinos on TV and radio.
Mm-hmm. And also women.
Definitely.
The telenovelas are notorious.
Yeah, I have to turn my TV to Channel 3. For cable programming. And there's these shows on there that are just, it's almost like soft porn.
Yes,
telenovelas are.
Well, yeah. I know they can get pretty wild.
But the way they portray the gay and lesbian Latinos on TV is as a comic relief or
right.
as someone that's lesser than.
And still a stereotypical.
Very stereotypical.
Over the top stereotypical.
Yeah, yeah.
Very stereotypical. Another organization that we're involved with nationally is called Unidos, which is the National Latino Latina Lesbian Gay Bisexual Transgender Human Rights Organization. And they're working on issues such as immigration. And we're very supportive of that organization nationally as well. I do have to say that Christina Martinez sits on the board of directors of Unidos.
Mm-hmm.
On the national level.
And on the state level?
On the state level, we're involved with an organization out of Austin called ALGO, Queer People of Color Organization. And we have just came back from a summit that they had a couple of weekends ago, and which included all of the Latino leaders involved in the GLBT communities. And Gaia was involved with that as well.
Well, I wasn't there. Now, wait a minute. On the local level, how is GAIO making a difference in the community?
Wow. Since our inception in 2005, Christina and myself have been busy. We have been involving ourselves with the mainstream Latino community, which is our first hurdle that we have to jump, because we have to be, not have to be accepted, but become accepted by the mainstream community. With that, we have been involved with festivals and parades. For example, the Sor Juana Festival, which is a Latino women's festival, and that one we worked with through Mecca. Another one was the LULAC's Cinco de Mayo Parade, and I must iterate that we are the first gay and lesbian Latino organization to be involved with a LULAC parade.
Wow.
So that was a very good accomplishment.
It's being received pretty well.
It has been, and just like I had mentioned to Christina, we have to show our face and let them know that who we are, and we're just like them.
Yeah.
And right now I'm involved with an organization that involves Tejano music, the Houston Tejano Music Coalition, and they have received me with open arms, and I'm working with many club members.
Are you a musician?
No, I'm not. I'm working with a lot of club owners and musicians hand in hand, and we seem to be working fine together.
That's wonderful. And that's such a rich culture and heritage there. I'm sure you saw La Mis Maluna. La misma luna.
La misma luna, the same moon.
Yeah, you saw that.
Yes.
The music in that, in the translation, was just enlightening. I loved it. It won the Sundance Film Festival, and it's a must see movie. Mm-hmm. It is, especially for people from down here this way, the Texas area. Yeah. We would really appreciate much of that movie. Now, some of the other things that your group has been involved in includes HIV awareness, the Latino AIDS Awareness Day in October.
Exactly.
Breast cancer awareness.
Latino women, for some reason, they don't seem to go get their mammograms. And we're really pushing that issue with Latino women.
Is that
All Latino women.
That reminds me, the Lesbian Health Initiative Health Fair is coming up June 7th at the Legacy Community Services, and there is an opportunity to get mammograms and other health care needs for anyone who doesn't have insurance or feels uncomfortable going somewhere else. Same-sex domestic violence.
Well, that is very prevalent in the Latino community, especially the gay and lesbian Latino community. There's nowhere for gay men to go, especially Latino men.
Uh-huh.
And the women have their shelters, but they have to keep their identity kind of hidden.
So in what ways do you work on that?
Well, we're trying to come up with workshops to help them overcome that and to seek help where help is needed.
And then another thing, and this is so important, is on health issues, diabetes and hypertension, which disproportionately affect the Hispanic community.
Very much so. We intend on working with medical personnel to bring the testing out to the community, not only here in the Montrose, but out and abroad where the Latino people live, to bring it out to them so they can get tested and be aware of some of the dangers that there is associated with diabetes and the hypertension.
Yeah. I know that you also have movie nights, and then you have the Latino, and I cannot pronounce.
I want to hear you say it. Come on.
Orgullo.
Orgullo is Spanish for pride. The week prior to the Gay Pride Parade, we designated that 3 years ago with Latino Orgullo Week.
Uh-huh.
We have a series of events that we have contacted club owners and other venues where we have events, such as maybe a dinner with Gallo, Latino night at such and such club. So, for more information on that, you can go to our website, and that'll be in the first part of June that we'll have that information out.
And that website is?
That website is www.houstongallo.org.
Okay, and I think Brian had some questions.
Well, with any 501c3 nonprofit organization, there's a need to raise money, and I understand you have a gala coming up.
That is correct.
Can you tell us about that?
Sure. Our Noche de Gala, which we call Noche de Gala, a black tie affair, will be Friday, June 27th, 2008, at the Greer and Loudermill Conference Center Grand Ballroom.
You know, I think that's the weekend of Pride.
It is.
And what a good time.
We coincide the dance with Pride. People come from all over Texas to Houston to celebrate Pride. And we have our Latino Pride Dance. And it's an annual event that stemmed from the early days of the 80s mm-hmm. to now. Mm-hmm. We've kept on the tradition, and we kept the ball rolling year after year.
It was ballet.
It was ballet back
ballet,
then. Correct.
Yes.
Correct.
One of the biggest and most popular events during Pride.
Yes. Now, here in Houston, with Gallo sponsoring the Noche de Gala, it has become the only black tie Latino affair during Gay Pride. And it's known all over Texas.
Absolutely. And the location of this is going to be?
It's going to be at the Greer and Loudermill Conference Center Grand Ballroom at 4225 Inchwood North Parkway. That's located near JFK and the Beltway by Intercontinental Airport.
Begins
at 8 o'clock till 1 in the morning.
And if you wanted to get tickets, where would you get those?
You would contact us at www.houstongallo.org, or you can call us on our Gallo phone line, which is 713-658-5198.
All right. And
this dance is benefiting our Gayo Scholarship Fund, and our beneficiaries will be Camp Hope, Lazarus Health, the Lexi Bowen Community Fund, and the GLBT Community Center. And the music will be provided by none other than Houston's powerhouse Aviso Band, live music.
Rockin'.
Yes, so it's a Latino Pride event, the Weekend of Pride.
But you don't have to be Latino, too.
Exactly.
You could be a Latino person who loves Latinos.
I personally have been deemed an honorary amiga.
Amiga.
Amiga de gallo.
Yes.
Very good.
The band is very diverse. They play country and western, rock, R&B, jazz, soul, everything. Plus, we have a DJ that'll play your dance music as well.
Oh, cool.
So everyone is invited.
Very good. So let's repeat the website.
www.houstongayo.org.
.org, not .com. And get all the information on the Gayo organization and the upcoming gala. And any other things you want to mention tonight to our listeners?
Before we close off, is there anything we didn't get said that you feel like is important?
I believe all the information that everyone needs about Gayo, about membership and everything, would be on the website. I would direct everyone there. And if they have any questions, give us a call on the phone.
Abel Rodriguez, thank you so much for being with us and sharing Cinco de Mayo.
Muchas gracias, amigo.
Muchas gracias.
Thank you.
Thank you very much.
This just in, as this program goes out, the Australian Capital Territory, yielding for the third time to the federal government, has abandoned its plan to introduce civil unions legislation. The territory instead plans a relationships registry specifying that any attendant ceremony will carry no legal weight. It's getting harder and harder to find a bookstore like Vancouver, BC's Little Sisters Book and Art Emporium. As the legendary landmark celebrates its 25th anniversary, many of its kind are no longer in business, despite their pivotal role in the development of both the early LGBT literary scene and burgeoning queer movement. This Way Out correspondent Heather Kitching commemorates Little Sister's silver milestone with Jim Diva, who co-founded the bookstore with his partner, Bruce Smith.
What was the day 25 years ago that you opened the doors of Little Sisters?
Actually, it was April 15th, 1983, but we had our grand opening on the first weekend in May.
Okay, so we're sort of on time here.
That's
with our
right.
little celebration. Had you started out thinking that you were going to go into the retailing business or the book business? How did the whole idea of Little Sisters come about way back then?
Well, it was sort of an evolution. I had just completed my Bachelor of Education in English and adored English. And I'd done a lot of retail and met my partner in Fort Simpson in the mid-70s. And we both worked for Hudson Bay Company, so we were Bay Boys. Deeply immersed in retail, so we both had a good retail background, and then of course a love of English, and then we were both gay, so it kind of all fit together in a weird way.
How did you find that first location that you had on Thurlow Street in that what appeared to be a house?
Well, I'll tell you a little story about that location that I don't think a lot know. We sort of found that we had been looking around for a month or two, and we found it, and we somehow thought that any second floor would be great for retail, so we actually rented it, signed a 5-year lease, went to the city hall to get our business license, and they pulled the records and they said you can't have retail on the second floor and it's not zoned retail, and you'd have to do a change of usage, it would be a big deal and it can't be done. So we Bruce and I were just like, I mean, really upset. So Bruce's idea was to come back the following day and try it again and just see if we get the same results. Well, we went back to City Hall the next day, and we got this very nice young woman. And we kind of charmed her and told her what we were up to, and she pulled the records, and she looked at it, and she said, you can't do it. It's not zoned for second floor retail. And we just sort of said, you know, this is our last opportunity, and it's, you know, really important that it's done, and it's sort of, it will work for retail. And so she just sort of took the stamp and looked at it and stamped it approved, and away it went. So without a very gracious clerk at City Hall, we never would have opened in that location. And I suspect, because we'd signed a lease, we would have gone broke. So it was sort of like it was meant to be.
So what was it like retailing to the gay community in the first few years? I mean, were you guys the first gay business in the area? Was there much of a community 25 years ago to support a bookstore?
Well, there wasn't any retail other than bars, but there was a really big, active bar scene with actually more bars than we have at the present time. And I would think, statistically, there were probably more gay people in the West End in 83 than there are at the present time.
Really?
Yeah, that was the 70s. You know, from mid-70 on, people migrated from across Canada to Davie Street. It was like a mecca. I mean, it was sort of very, very liberal. There were, you know, streetwalkers on the street. I mean, the place was wild. It was amazing. And it was very vibrant, and lots of very young people coming from all across Canada. So it was, it was a magic time. And it was a great time to start a gay business.
Mm-hmm. So you guys did well then from the start?
No. I remember the first day our sales were $67. it took about 5 or 6 years to get people, first aware of the booming, you know, amount of literature that was coming out, because that was also at the time when there was so much gay publishing from small presses that were opening up across North America. So it took some time to get people engaged and realizing, you know, the significance and the span of the gay literature. And then, of course, we started bringing in more stuff that they would like cards and lubricants and all sorts of things. So it took us a while to sort of position ourselves. Probably the first 4 years were a major struggle, mm-hmm, financially, but, with cutting corners and living really frugally, it worked, you know. We lived in the store for almost a year in a back room office, so we didn't have any expenses at all. The bathroom, we had to go through the store to get to the bathroom, so it was not the best. It had no showers. We had to rely on friends to go and shower. But we cut costs, and so we could live on next to nothing, mm-hmm, and slowly grow the business.
Wow. Before we get into the bad times, I mean, you know, tell me a little more about the good memories that you have. I mean, were you guys hosting events there and stuff as well?
And oh, indeed. And we had a coffee counter in the back, and which we had a pink pig, and everybody had to pay into the pig, or they should, when they had coffee. And it became a place for people to meet and talk and discuss issues. And that started in the first year and built slowly and built a fairly faithful clientele that it was kind of their home, their drop-off center. They'd come in once a day and check in. And so it was always very social, and it certainly was more social the first 10 years when there was less retail and more visiting.
Mm-hmm. You are most famous outside of Vancouver for having fought a case to the Supreme Court of Canada against Canada Customs for seizing shipments of books that were bound for Little Sisters.
Mm-hmm.
And because obscene material is illegal in Canada, they had the power to inspect shipments of books for obscene material.
Mm-hmm.
But what was happening was your books were being held up for like a year sometimes while totally unqualified customs officers were attempting to read a book and determine its artistic merit, is kind of what was happening, as I understand it. Is that right?
Indeed, that is what was happening. They were making some really foolish decisions based on guidelines that were not governed by any existing laws. So they were kind of on their own going at it. And they knew that it would be so expensive and onerous for any business to take them to court that they never really had to answer for what they were doing, and of course thought they had ultimate power. So our basic job was just to pull their chain really hard.
Mm-hmm. So when did this start happening to you? Like, when did Customs suddenly figure out, hey, wait a second, there's a gay bookstore?
Right, 86. 86 it started. So we had a couple of years without them, which was great because it allowed us to kind of organize and get together and get a some kind of an economic base to keep going. And, yeah, in 86, in the latter part of 86, they started seizing pretty well everything that was crossing the border and releasing very little of it.
And how did it affect you?
It was really quite, it was quite terrifying. And that's when we realized that we were going to have to go extremely public with it, and we were going to have to create, you know, a public cry against what they were doing. And that's when we went to the media and began to really organize and do it as a campaign. And over the years, it was extremely effective, but it started slowly, and it built up, and more people became involved. And it became very, very powerful. Probably the most help was came from the BC Civil Liberties, who were very, very helpful. They were well-funded at that time and had the power to bring in lawyers and deal with court actions. So they were absolutely, without them, we couldn't have gone forward.
Did you find when you started the PR campaign that the customs seizures let up a little bit? Did you manage to shame them?
No, that took a court action, and it actually didn't start until we started doing discoveries and they realized what they had been up to. I don't think the hierarchy really realized how sort of systemic it was, and then I think they began to panic, and that's when they took off all mention of anal penetration, because before that, that was on the top of the list of things to look for. Just 2 weeks before the court case, they dropped that as one of the guidelines, and that was the one that was causing us, of course, the most problem.
Mm-hmm,
and they defended that adamantly, like, you know, the world could not survive if there were any depictions or descriptions of anal penetration. I mean, absolutely ridiculous.
So Customs was seizing your books, and Customs officers had been told that anything that contains an image of anal penetration is obscene, so they were just, banning things willy-nilly because...
Any description of anal penetration would have destroyed the nation.
My goodness.
Yeah.
It was around 1986 that you began this process, and one of the most visible faces of your struggle was your manager, Janine Fuller. So when did Janine join in your...
The spring of 1990.
Okay.
Yeah.
Tell us about your relationship with Janine.
Well, it's been amazing. But in 1990, the Gay Games came to Vancouver, and that was really one of the very, very important sort of growth cycles of our community. And, I mean, that was a major thing at the time, and we knew it was going to be very good for our business and the fact that we'd be much busier. So we started hiring people for almost the first time, and so we put out an ad and got it bombarded by different people that wanted to work there. And once we met Janine, and we realized that it was important that she work with us and for us. So it happened, very quickly, and it just worked from day one. Mm-hmm. I mean, she was just the right person at the right time.
What made you? What drew you to her?
She was terribly committed. She had worked in the gay bookstore in Vancouver, in Toronto, the women's bookstore in Toronto. So she was well versed on book selling, and she was well plugged into the arts community, and just a tremendous resource that she brought with her.
Mm-hmm. And did she know that she was going to be handling your censorship case?
Not at all. No.
you saved that one.
Yes, we did, and it slowly sort of built, and she was just the perfect person, the perfect fit to be dealing with the media and the lawyers and all of that, and gets along with everybody, and that's very helpful, too.
Mm-hmm. Now, at the same time that the court case was getting off to a start, you were also bombed at least twice.
Yeah, three times.
So, I mean, when did those things happen, and what kind of damage was done to the store?
It hit the stairwell twice and sort of tore the stairwell up. It was actually a percussion grenade that's used by the military in their war games. So it has the percussion of a bomb, but without the object that created the destruction. So it's the movement of air. So it, bashed in all of the plaster and knocked stuff off and tore 2x4s out and did damage, and if people had been close enough to it, they certainly would have been very severely hurt. But luckily, no one was seriously hurt. We had one person taken to the ambulance in the second bombing, I think, or taken away in an ambulance, but not too badly, just respiration problems. I had one go off about 8 feet from me. Like, I watched it roll in and blow, and I saw a red cloud come up, and of course, and I was covered in glass. It was absolutely terrifying when it happened. Very close to, you know, doing bad damage. I couldn't hear properly for about a month, and light sensitive, and it was, you know, it was an issue. But we worked through it, and it, in the end, it made us stronger and more determined to do what we were doing.
Mm-hmm.
And we were open all of the occasions. We opened the following day.
Wow.
They had to step over stuff and around stuff, but we were open. I mean, there's no way that we would allow them to close anything by that kind of terrorist act, and that's what it was.
The epic story of Little Sisters David and Goliath battle with Canada Customs continues in part two of Heather Kitching's conversation with co-owner Jim Diva, including comments by the store's longtime manager, Janine Fuller.
Our first experience with trying to get the magazine The Advocate into Canada, a magazine that is a very mainstream, almost people magazine, specifically really American in its origin, originally was a banned magazine in Canada, and it was our bookstore that took Canada Customs to court over the right to bring that magazine into Canada.
More on the Little Sisters saga next time on This Way Out. Thanks for tuning into This Way Out, the international lesbian and gay radio magazine. This week, Tanya Kane Ferry, John Beaupre, Rex Walkner with Bill Kelly, Sherry Lunn, and Heather Kitching contributed program material. Annabelle Chvostek performed some of the music you heard, and Kim Wilson composed and performed our theme music. Listen online to This Way Out exclusively at outinamerica.com. You can also click on the Listen Now banner at the top of our website, thiswayout.org. This Way Out operating expenses are underwritten by a grant from the Kicking Assets Fund of the Tides Foundation and through direct charitable donations from our listeners. Thank you. Please log on to thiswayout.org to see how you can help keep this program on the air and choose from several special CD thank you gifts. You can also subscribe to CDs or cassettes of our programs there. To receive weekly email messages describing the content of each This Way Out program, email tworadio@aol.com. You can also write to us at P.O. Box 38327, Los Angeles, California, 90038, USA. For Associate Producer Lucia Chappella and all of us at This Way Out, I'm Greg Gordon. Thanks for listening on Boise Community Radio, Boise, Idaho, CKDU, Halifax, Nova Scotia, Trance FM, Broward County, Florida, and more than 175 other stations around the world, including this community radio station. And we're all going to stay tuned.
At 90.1 FM, this is KPFT Houston. Now, more of Queer Voices with Jack Walensky and the entire Queer Voices crew.
Hi, I'm Brian Erickson, and I'm looking over here at my pal
Brian with a Y, Lavinka.
And I'm wondering, what color is that bandana in the back of your pocket? Is that mustard or is that gold lamé?
Well, that's a good question, Brian. It's actually mustard. And if you're a devotee of the leather community, or if you go to a leather bar, leather event, then you know that there are hankies and there are hanky codes, and the list goes on and on. So tonight we wanted to kind of talk about that, the leather community in Houston, and we are joined by none other than Daddy Bob, Sir Robert, and Miss Christy.
Hello.
Hi.
Hello.
How are y'all doing tonight?
Great.
Doing good.
Okay, it's nice to have you on here. Coming up big is, I was wondering if Brian was taking starting his journey up to IML in Chicago.
You know, I've never been to IML. I've been to Folsom Fair, Folsom Street in San Francisco, and that was an eye-opener, let me tell you.
But most
I've heard IML is even more exciting.
Who here has been to IML?
I have. Daddy Bob.
Daddy Bob, can you tell us about a little bit about IML?
It's the International Mr. Leather Contest. It's held May the 22nd through the 26th in Chicago. It's contestants from all over the world. And we've had two from Texas win in the last few years. I'm not sure of the dates.
And how does one get involved with IML? I mean, does it just everybody just wants to go show up, go? Can I just go this year?
Someone who's won a title for a bar or a leather store, a sponsor, someone who has sponsored them and they've won the contest, have a title, then they can go to the contest.
So it's like the Miss Gay America, Miss Gay Texas pageant, where you win a certain level and then you go on to the grand, the national level.
Sort of, yes. We're doing.
I don't know if you're wearing a dress or anything.
Yeah, no ball gowns. Leather made of leather.
And even then, you better pull it off right.
Well, you know, I mean, there's just so much about the leather community that maybe our listeners are not aware of. You know, I recently attended an event the other day, and it was brought up that we were going to do bondage in a bag, and I just thought, oh my lord, this is it for me. And it turned out it was a whole lot of fun in the bag, and it was you know, getting somebody all tied up with they had latex gloves, they had little glasses to put on, they had
Hawaiian lays
things like that. Not the things that I'm thinking are going to be in here, because it's always just like, oh my lord, you know, this is just something that's,
you know, we do this program every Monday night, and Brian always comes back with all these fantastic tales of things going on, and I'm just like amazed.
We've got to get you out.
Well, he was telling me about the Louis weekend, and I know that's a big kind of out of town fun weekend right after Mardi Gras, and he was telling me all about that and all the things that go on, and I was just like, oh, very, very interested.
Well, yeah, and go ahead and somebody tell us something about the Louis weekend or the runs. It was just the NLA run. I mean, and Robert is the president of the National Leather Association.
Houston chapter.
Houston chapter, that is. So what's with the run, and where does the run go, and how does that involve with the community?
Well, know? Most of the leather clubs, or most of the clubs in the Houston area or all over the world, will hold their anniversaries. And their anniversaries may be for one night, it may be for an entire day, it may be for a weekend. And it's just a chance for the groups to get out there and really celebrate their club and have the community come together and help them celebrate their anniversary.
Okay, so in Houston there's just one club?
No, we've actually got, as far as the leather clubs go, there is, oh boy, we've got NLA Houston, the Misfits,
Fire Dancers,
Houston Leather Boys.
Houston Leather Boys, Lone Star Boys of Leather. Let's see, there's Houston's Big Men's Club.
Whip
Society.
Mm-hmm.
Let's see, Houston Area Bears. They're the two courts. So you have ERESIS and ICOH, which are both big supporters of the leather community.
This all comes under the Houston Council of Clubs, and they're the ones that sponsor Louis.
Right.
And that's not even to mention all the pansexual clubs that Houston has.
Tell us about that.
Well, Eros is a big organization that's good for education. They have meetings every Saturday afternoon. Club Femme is another club that's out there, and they're for femdoms and male slaves. So there's a lot going on in Houston.
Yeah, that brings up an interesting point. We're talking about dominance and submissives, okay? And from what I know, all of y'all are on the dominant side. That's correct, right?
Yes. Correct.
That is, yeah.
Okay, now, what one might want to know is...
That's the left side, right?
Correct, yes.
Correct.
Yeah, correct.
The opposite side of us.
Yes. Hey.
Oh, he might be a lefty. Lefty, righty, I don't know.
Both,
we grow
he's
in
versatile. Depends. He's a switch.
It just depends on the role now. That's a great part to bring up, because if you are a dominant, can you become a submissive, or vice versa?
Yes.
Yes.
It's not uncommon. It is unusual, but it's not uncommon. I've known several daddies and masters who have made the switch. They have a boy or a slave, and they become a slave or a boy to another stronger dom than they are.
Okay, so it's a lot of it is by choice.
Always by choice. And it's always consensual.
Always consent. Now, how do we go about a consensual process? I mean, what do we do for a negotiation? I mean, is there negotiations that occur?
In a sub, it's normally in their heart to serve. And if it's not in their heart and their mind, they will not. They are just playing a role.
Exactly. They can fake it, but there's always a difference. You can always tell. Now, how do I elaborate on that? I don't.
Well, okay, let's go about that. Can you fake it till you make it, as they might say? I mean, does somebody just pop out and just have all the gear and is ready to go and that's that? Or, you know?
No, in that case.
Toe in the water.
Yeah, no. Well, it's those of us who are in the scene, you can spot it. You know the people who are out there. They're faking it. They've bought their leather because, oh my God, I look so hot in this, or they show up expecting, telling people that, oh, I'm a dominant and I've got such and such, and they tell their stories, and the stories just don't fit with how the life really works, and you can spot those pretty easy.
I know 30 years ago when I bought my first leather, it was because I liked the look, and then I went to the bar, and the doms and the subs both came up to me, and it scared the hell out of me. So I put the stuff away for about 6 months, pulled it back out, and got my feet very, very slowly wet. And I thought I knew everything, and I still don't know half of what goes on.
You know, I've been around the ripcord here a little bit, and
that's our primary leather place to go, thing, I guess.
That houses a lot of the events. Not all of the events. I mean, but any of the major events I've seen there, but they are also other places as well.
Right, the 611, Mary's, EJ's, mm-hmm. Tony's Corner Pocket,
BRB.
The BRB.
Yeah. You know, and I want to say that, you know, when we're talking about this, what Sir Robert was saying is, you know, you'll see somebody in there with a cap that might be a master's hat, and they're like, you know, they're a twink. And it's just like, what's that about? Because I want to say one of the coolest things that I ever saw in one of my first events was, if I may, I want to say I saw somebody receive their master's hat. And it was done in the formal way. And it was really neat to experience. And there's a lot of pride and there's a lot of tradition in that. And so where is the leather community going as far as, is there a base of it with them that understand this tradition? I mean, is it getting stronger? What's happening?
Well, actually, I just received my leather vest a couple months ago, and I was blown away. I was completely shocked, and it was a huge moment for me.
Now, what does that mean? You received your leather vest? What was the ceremony, and what did that mean to you exactly?
What it meant to me is that I had been recognized by my peers, and they thought, you know, what I'd been trying to do and how I'd been trying to live my life had been noticed by people who stepped up and basically, you know, gave me a pat on the back and said, you know, we acknowledge the journey that you have taken. Even though I must say, the boys let me wear sweatpants when they knew in advance that I was going to this big ceremony. Sweatpants. Okay.
And the Don's in attendance knew too. So.
They knew I was surprised too, since I showed up in sweatpants.
We won't ask about what happened with the boys.
Oh, sure, go for it.
Let's go.
Well, let's go back to that. I mean, what do you see as the future of the leather community? I know our community in general is kind of having an apathy and kind of this kind of feeling that maybe gay culture isn't relevant. I mean, we're kind of blending in. Is that the same in the leather community, or where is it at today?
I don't think there's apathy, but that's just me. Maybe because I'm passionate about it. I've been told that, you know, leather comes off as elitist. And for a long time, I was bothered by that. And the more I think about it, the more I'm not bothered by that. Because I don't think that anybody who just buys the stuff off the rack and walks in and calls themselves master should be accepted and taken at face value that they are a master. I think that it's something that needs to be earned, and I think as long as we hold to those principles and to our core values, that it won't fall by the wayside.
So being in the leather community is more than just owning a piece of leather.
Yes, exactly.
It's a lifestyle, per se.
It's how you live your life and how people see you living your life. Wow, that sounded deep.
That's what it is.
Yeah. Are you going to exemplify how you live your lifestyle by running for Mr. or Ms. Leather? What's that about, Bob?
That, this is a title that's coming up in September and October. And the person that enters the contest has to have it in their heart and in their soul to be in part of the leather community. It's not just buying leather and putting it up and having a beauty contest on stage. have to understand the inner workings of the leather community. And it's not the S&M community a part of the leather. It is the that's a small part of it. It's all, everything in the global.
The leather world.
Leather world, yeah.
And don't they have a lot of responsibilities once they win the title? It's not just, you know, getting to wear the sash.
There will be fundraisers that they have to do, at least probably two a year. Those are the main ones. Then from there, they will go to, like, the Mr. Texas Leather Contest, which then goes to, feeds into the IML, International Mr. Leather Contest.
Well, you know, what if I just don't feel like I could be up to being Mr. Leather Houston that is?
Mm-hmm, correct.
Is there any other kinds of titles that I could try to run for?
Actually, surprisingly enough, there is in July, we have the Boy of Montrose contest that is going to be coming up.
You know, I always see that at Mary's. I'm always kind of intrigued because I always see that, like, sign.
Actually, that one's different. Though,
oh,
that's
that?
The
okay.
Daddy of Montrose and the Mother of Montrose. The Boy of Montrose is held at the Ripcord.
Okay.
And what's different about those is the Daddy of Montrose and the Mother of Montrose are both titles that are owned by Mary's Bar.
Ah, I gotcha.
And the Boy of Montrose is a title that was created by Don Gill for the PWA Holiday Charities. So,
and that's one of the major fundraisers, I understand.
Right. That the winner of the Boy of Montrose is required to put on three fundraisers throughout the year, mm-hmm. and that feeds all of that money. It goes directly into the PWA Holiday Charities Working Fund.
What are some of the other fundraisers that y'all do? You say the PWA Holiday Charities.
Well, Holiday Charities is one of the probably the largest fundraising.
I know that I think the courts support that. I mean, there's a lot of different organizations that support that.
Yeah, Holiday Charities does a lot.
And NLA does toy drives, clothing drives.
Mm-hmm. Benefiting Thomas Street Clinic mm-hmm. right now.
There was even a benefit for Don Gill himself, wasn't there?
That, we did that over at the BRB.
At the BRB, I'm just here thinking about... the Mr. and Miss Leather, who's sponsoring that?
Black Hawk Leather.
Yay.
And
7-Eleven.
That's very close to the Ripcord, I understand.
Next door and inside the Ripcord.
Next door and inside the Ripcord. And let's see here, as far as, have you already decided who will be hosting this event, or are they emceeing?
The Ripcord will be hosting the event, and Master Robert and Miss Christie will be...
Sir Robert.
And Miss Christie saw...
No, wait, okay, wait, I just saw a whip get pulled out.
No. Well, I'm only a daddy.
Okay, so let's talk about this. There's the master, the sir, the daddy.
That's right.
What are the different responsibilities, or how does that role play out, per se? I'm just wondering.
Someone who is called a master is someone who has been recognized by the committee, or by the community, that upholds all the standards and the protocols of everything that we consider our leather life.
Mm-hmm.
Through the way that they act, what's in their heart, their mind, and basically exemplifying the honor, integrity, loyalty, and respect to everyone. And when that title is presented, it's generally presented with their master's cover or their cap. And that's why it can be a little bit offensive when you're sitting in the bar and you have someone who just walked in off the street and bought it because it looked hot. And in the old guard, years ago, if someone walked in and did not have that right to wear it, that hat would be knocked off their head.
Mm-hmm.
So it's a little bit upsetting. But and before that, you hit the sir level.
Yes, you're Sir Roberts.
I am. I was given the title by Master Buzz, who's here in Houston, mm-hmm. about 2 years ago. I received my cover last year at the Nomads Run, which is another one of the leather clubs.
Mm-hmm.
Then there's other titles. There's Daddy.
You said boy?
Miss. Yeah, on the submissive side, there's boy, slave, sub. Let's see what else.
And I want to say, does it even break down into different kinds of degrees within those levels? Do they break down
further? Well, yes. Nailing down any one of them is virtually impossible.
Yeah.
You'll find, we'll take a boy, a submissive, a slave. They carry a lot of the same traits. I think it's what the person feels inside. I personally believe that, you know, if a boy says he's a boy, he's a boy. If he says he's a slave, he's a slave. I happen to have a boy, and he is cheeky, and he is not what you would expect as a slave, but he's fun.
Mm.
And I find boys tend to be a little more brash. They're a little more likely to, you know, tie your straw in a knot when you go to the bathroom. They're likely to do fun things. And they're likely to question more, whereas, you know...
Slave is just going to... be there and do what
very
you tell
submissive.
Them.
Yeah. Very submissive.
That's the theory, but that doesn't mean you're not going to get any. And if you ask them to do something, you're not going to, you know, get a little.
There can be a female boy spelled B-O-I as well.
Wow. Mm-hmm.
And they're hot.
And there's nothing wrong with, you know, saying hot, you know, hot female boys out there.
Mm. Yeah, that's true.
And if so, my number is.
So, let's see. Did we go back over what's coming up in events-wise after IML? Anything here in Houston?
First is the
Bear Watch.
When is the Bear Watch?
Bear Watch is not this weekend, but next weekend.
The 16th, 17th, and
18th. In Galveston.
Galveston.
And that's in Galveston now. Is there something else that weekend on that Friday night? Is that the same third Friday
the
night?
The third Friday of every month. Blackhawk Leather sponsors the Fetish Friday on the Ripcord Patio at 10 o'clock. That's for people who are curious about different fetishes. Can be flogging, paddling, tickling, anything that they're curious about. We're glad to show them and demonstrate it without any fear of being hurt. There's always medical people in the bar. We are in all walks of life. And it just makes it, they don't have to date someone to find out, gosh, I want to get something done to me, but I don't want to date him.
Right.
Or marry him.
Which, hey, some of us feel the same way. I just want to tie you up. I don't want anything else.
And what else goes on at the Ripcord? On
the first Friday of every month, they do the leather dress code at 10 o'clock out on the back patio as well.
Okay.
And if you're not in some sort of major leather garment, you can't go back in the back area. There, it's just a social for like-minded people.
Yeah, you know, I mean, just so that they know, what's the address there at the Ripcord?
715 Fairview, which is at the corner of Fairview and Crocker.
I find it very hard to believe that no one in the gay Houston community would not know where the Ripcord is. I mean, it's a long-standing club. I mean,
surprisingly enough, I met someone this weekend who had been here for a year and had never known that the Ripcord was there.
So. They seek it out. They can smell it out. They know. When there was an article on it in the Houston Press about a month ago.
Really?
It was in the music section, because as it was talking about their selection of music. So, a nice write-up in that.
I want to say, is there anything that we have not asked you at this point that you'd like to bring up, that you'd like the listeners to know about?
The only one thing I do want to iterate on the Fetish Leather Friday night is you don't have to be in leather, and it's not a dress code. It's open to male and female.
So that's the point we should probably make, that we're not just exclusively for men, women, or even gay. I mean, this is also a straight thing as well.
Exactly. Oh, yeah.
Yeah, so the leather community kind of is all-encompassing.
It is.
And the Ripcord is a neighborhood bar. It may be known as the gay men's leather bar, but it is a neighborhood bar.
Depends on what neighborhood you live in.
And that's very true, because, you know, if you don't come out and it's not open to all, then, you know, it doesn't give everybody an opportunity. And, you know, that here in this community, I think that's what we really want to push, you know. We really fight for an opportunity, you know, to be heard and to live our lives the way we'd like to.
Exactly.
I know, I was real nervous when I first started attending the Ripcord, because, you know, it is... has always had the reputation of being a men's gay leather bar. And I have a lot of fun at the Ripcord. I mean, I'm there far too often, actually.
Is there such a thing as too often?
No, there's not. I get to wear leather. I get to dress up.
You get to put that spike in your hair.
I do love the spike.
Yeah.
Actually, if I can, the one thing I'd like to say is that if you are interested in becoming a member of the leather community or learning about it, if you come out to the bar and you see someone in leather, just ask. The leather folk are very welcoming and open, just as long as there's that respect that's given.
I'm glad you brought that up. What if I wanted to become a member or join the Misfits or the Fire Dancers or become a part of the NLA? Can I just go out and join, or do I? How
is there a website that kind of has all the information?
Well, NLA has our website, which is www.nlahoustontx.org.
NLAHoustonTX.org.
Right, and that's NLA's site. Most of the clubs are guest bartenders at the Ripcord on every Saturday night. So if you want to see the Misfits or the Fire Dancers or NLA, if you come out on a Saturday night, we're going to be on the back patio bartending. You can always talk to a member. and talk about joining.
And NLA actually has their meeting tomorrow night at the Ripcord at 8 o'clock, and that's open to the public.
Right.
It's the first Tuesday of every month.
Yes.
Yep. So tomorrow night, 8 o'clock, at the Ripcord, the NLA Houston chapter. And will you be presiding as the...
I will. I, as president,
as
I
must. As Presidente?
I must.
And this is the second time to win the election.
Yeah. How often?
Third term.
I'm sorry.
Ooh. Yeah, third term.
Third term of regular George Washington.
Ooh, political reference. Ooh.
No.
But I was thinking of the father, the daddy, you know, the father of the country, you know, it all kind of ties.
It all ties together.
How often are, how long are the terms?
The terms are based for 1 year.
Okay.
And this is my final year. I will not run again. I didn't really want to run this year.
Okay,
so put that down so we know that's for sure.
No, because I believe too much in change. I really think every organization needs to change, and you need new blood in leadership all the time.
And speaking of change, there's something really exciting right now with NLA Houston. We are planning our Spring Iniquity Conference for the first time in years that will be next year. So there's a lot going on, and it's a perfect time to come in, come out, be a part of.
You can watch the whole year as it progresses.
And even volunteer to help without becoming a member.
You come out there and we'll put you to work.
I believe NLA Houston has got one of the largest memberships in Houston, doesn't it? As an individual club?
We do. Actually, Euresis beats us.
Okay.
But as far as the leather clubs go, yes, we do.
You know, one more time, if there's any last thing that you want the listeners out there to hear, because we're...
I just want to say thank you for having us on and letting us...
Well, you know, and in that way, I'd also like to know if y'all would like to come back again, because there's probably lots more questions that are going to build up, and, you know, we'd like to get you guys coming back out sometime, you know,
sure.
In
certainly.
The next couple months. You know, we can talk about more events. But
you invite us, we'll be back.
Well, absolutely. On behalf of the Bryans, I'd like to thank Daddy Bob.
Thank you.
Sir Robert. And Miss Christy.
Miss Christy, who's a diva by...
Thank you very much.
And you're listening to Queer Voices.
Sound the alarm. It's an emergency. You're waving your arms. Are you deserting me? Evidence has shown we've seen this all before. You're covered and blown, and we
Situation by the Ex-Boyfriends.
This is Queer Voices.
As a gay man, I typically avoid vaginas at all costs. Just call me, you know, I'm a gay boy. But we
are
have.
Are you really?
I am.
And I, on the other hand,
have a vagina.
Being one of the two people in this room that has a vagina. And I am quite fond of them.
Well, you know, for me, I would avoid vaginas. But in this case, with the vagina monologues coming up at Theater New West, I absolutely advocate going and hearing and seeing all about vaginas.
Well, you know what? 10 years ago, Eve Ensler wrote her revolutionary screenplay, Vagina Monologues. And it started off Broadway, and it's become a worldwide phenomenon.
Oh, yeah, it's a worldwide phenomenon.
Yeah, it's more than just the play. And there, it's raised consciousness. It's raised body self-esteem. It's helped women all over. Any group can perform free of any copyright the play as long as they donate their money to a cause such as the Women's Center or something that helps women.
Oh, yeah,
so that's pretty,
absolutely.
Pretty amazing.
Now, I understand that the Houston production of this has a twist. There's a special thing going
on
with it.
A little different.
A little bit, you know.
Well, I don't consider being transgender different.
I don't either. I mean, it's part of our community. But, I mean, has this been done before anywhere?
Yes, it has. I'm Jennifer Renee, and I have the rare privilege tonight to actually be the one being interviewed instead of the other way around. It's almost awkward.
Isn't it?
Yeah.
Well. Kind of nervous about what we're going to ask, right?
Yes. Now's our chance, Brian.
Oh, my God.
So, first of all, tell us what is happening with the production of the Vagina Monologues here in Houston. That's, I think, opening on May 8th.
It's official opening is Friday, May 9th. This coming Friday.
This Friday. Ooh.
Yes, this coming Friday, and it'll run. It'll be performed on Fridays and Saturdays through May 31st. There is a special benefit performance for the Montrose Counseling Center on May 8th, because. Good reason. We're performing at the Montrose Counseling Center, the new facility at 401 Brannard. And we start at 8 o'clock. That's the curtain. So if you want to come, you want to get tickets, simplest thing to do, just call 713-522-2204 and get your reservations. Get them in early.
This is, of course, with Joe Watts.
Yes.
One of the first people in Houston to do out gay theater.
Oh, yes. And pioneer.
In his Theater New West group, which might be at home from now on at the Montrose Counseling Center,
that's
a possibility.
Right. That's the hope that the Montrose Counseling Center, its new facility, it has a large meeting room that is ideal for the kind of performances we're doing for the Vagina Monologues, but also other stage performances will work fine. And that's the intention, is that this will be the first
performance in the Montrose Counseling Center, but also will be the new home of New West.
You know, wow. I followed Theater New West for years, and it's moved several times, so hopefully this will be the home for
yes,
the theater.
No, it won't be the gypsy troupe.
But it's managed. As much to Joe's credit, that he's been able to do what he's done,
absolutely.
Whether it be a loft somewhere or a Baring and James Gallery.
Art gallery. It was at the old 1415 California.
Yeah, yes. And, I mean, that was a pretty decent space there.
Mm-hmm. I've seen many a great
yes, it was. I was had gone to several performances there.
Yeah.
And, you know, and to speak to that, it's been many years since I've been on the stage. It's where I started was on the stage.
I was going to ask you, how did you get involved with
this? I've been on the stage since I was 4 years old. Believe it or not, I'm not going to say how long that's been. But
she was a cute little boy.
I was a cute little boy then.
Now she's a
cute
woman. Sultry woman.
Oh, yeah. Come on. More. And so I was on stage, and I did a lot of dinner theater, a lot of community theater, and then I stopped doing it because of my other careers. I say careers, this way it's been in my life. And I stopped doing stage because it takes so much time, you know, and effort and energy, and I just didn't have it splitting it between other things.
Right, right.
But when this opportunity came up to do the Vagina Monologues, I jumped at the opportunity to audition, and I was fortunate enough to be selected by Joe as one of the, and this is the twist, y'all know there's no big secret, if there is, you'll be surprised anyway, and that is that the entire cast are transgender.
Very good.
Now, the Vagina Monologues is a poignant and hilarious tour of the last frontier, the ultimate forbidden zone. It's a celebration of female sexuality in all its complexity and mystery. Held as the Bible for a new generation of women, it has been performed in cities all across the world and at hundreds of college campuses and has inspired a dynamic grassroots movement, V-Day, to stop violence against women.
Absolutely.
Witty and irreverent, compassionate and wise, Eve Ensler's Obie Award-winning masterpiece gives voice to real women's deepest fantasies and fears, guaranteeing that no one who sees it will ever look at a woman's body or think of sex in quite the same way again. And Joe said that when he saw the documentary of the L.A. production that was presented by Transgenders...
Which answers your question.
He became passionate about directing a similar production in Houston. And his intent was in no way to sensationalize or exploit the transgender community any more than the L.A. production was, but to give them a voice, one of the better understanding, acceptance, dignity, clarity, and beauty. And would you say that that has been accomplished in this, Jennifer Renee?
Oh, yes, absolutely. I so admire Joe. We've interviewed him, and I've interviewed him a number of times here on this show, and getting the opportunity to work with him, as I was saying earlier, it had been a long time since I've been on stage, but with his guidance and direction, he actually makes it easy. If you can memorize your lines, he will give you that kind of energy and direction you need to really make it a success.
Does he kind of let you develop the character yourself, or does he have something in mind specifically and just says, you know, do it this way?
He has a vision to begin with. He has a vision, and what he's done is he selected the talent that he thought could fill his vision, and then he lets us get in there, and he'll guide us. I hate to say just direction, because that sometimes sounds almost dictatorial. But what he does do, he guides us. He says, you know, make the most of that line. Maybe you should say it this way instead of that way. And when it happens, and when he says that, you go, wow, why didn't I think of that? And the reason is that we don't think of it as talent is because we're so close to the words that sometimes we miss the meaning and what's trying to be said. And he's able to give that to us from that third person perspective. And it's just wonderful. It's been a delight working with him. And what he does too is get a lot out of us. And the cast is coming together as a team, a real cast working together. Because in rehearsals, sometimes you stall. Your brain has blank spot in it, and somebody will whisper the line because we're all watching out for each other. So that's just wonderful.
So tell us about some of the other members of the cast, and was there a significant competition to gain the parts?
There were a lot from, I don't know the exact number, Joe knows the number, but there were a lot of people who wanted to do it. Matter of fact, there were a number of just actresses in the community that wanted to audition, but it couldn't because they had to be transgender. One of my dearest girlfriends, who's just fabulous as an actress, she said, I knew that you would get it because I couldn't do it. I wanted to audition for it.
And there's six primary roles?
Six primary roles, and we've got one of them is Stacey Meyer Colt. And Stacey Colt is a female-to-male transgender and is absolutely fabulous. And then George Samanik is also a female-to-male. Raphael Apachino.
Ooh.
I know. Hey, that's what he told me just before I left. I came here just from the rehearsal. Is a cross-dresser and expresses his gender differently. And then Julia Oliver, who is a male-to-female transsexual, who is the Houston PD sergeant who transitioned on the job.
That's right. That's right. I knew that name seemed familiar.
That's why. So
and
she's part of
wow.
this.
Wow.
And, of
Jasmine.
Course, Jasmine Pierce. And she's a performer here locally in the drag shows and does the competitions myself. And of course, Joe is our director. It's a great cast, great people.
Now, I was thinking that this seems very timely in light of all of kind of the recognition and visibility of the transgender community with, you know, the ENDA and HRC and all of that. I think this is a very timely production with featuring a transgender cast in Houston.
I think so, too. Since you mentioned ENDA, which means HRC, HRC is supporting
Human
Rights Campaign. Thank you. They are
so-called.
They are planning on being making a one specific night. They're going to fill the auditorium with their people, and hopefully, you know, more than that. I know that a number of other groups have spoken that they're going to try to bring their people all in one group. Sort of fill the place up and make it their own little night.
How many people can this in the theater sit?
Right now it's set up for somewhere between 80 and 90 seats. And the reason I say that is because we're still rehearsing in another area, and it's not been set up in the auditorium itself yet.
Well,
but I will say this much, it's going to be very close to the audience. Only going to be three rows, which means
intimate.
That you're going to be, I'm going to be performing right there in front of you. We can reach out and
I've seen a couple of the Theater New West productions, and it's always very intimate, and I always appreciate it. That's the best theater. You feel like
much like Theater Lab is like that. It's small, it's intimate. You feel like you're drawn into it. Now,
you become part of the cast almost. You're right there where the person's like they're talking right to you.
Yeah, and stages, even though it's larger, often have
absolutely.
That. Now I was a bit surprised to find out that there were trans men that were taking part in this. I mean, I was thinking, well, it's all going to be male to female.
Yes, you need to shift your paradigm there.
Really, people that went out and got vaginas that didn't have them before.
Well. Joe wanted to make sure
apparently
it's possible.
Maybe some people that had them or still have them because some trans men don't do away with that part of their anatomy.
I was going to see how you were handling that. Dancing shoes, been tap dancing.
Really? I'm pretty well informed about the transgender community, so I was trying to think of how to word it because a lot of people may not realize even though we've talked about it on the show before, and we'll again, the variations of what people choose to do in their gender expression.
Gender expression and gender identity.
Right.
Yes.
Right.
Well, in the case of the female to male, all of them, they're on hormones and all, but many times the technology to make the
apparatus
genital reassignment surgery be effective is still in its infancy for the female to male.
Mm-hmm.
So many of the female to males don't have that surgery.
Well, and also it works the other way. There are many male to female that choose not to have surgery and just use hormones because if you really study about gender and sexuality, it's not about the genitalia. That a man or a woman does not make. There's so many other things that can be in there.
Exactly. And many people don't understand that we talk about it, and the simplest way of putting it is that sex is about what's between your legs. Gender is about what's between your ears.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. You, as a transgendered woman, did you find in participating in this, hearing the stories that the other people are portraying, and your own part, which I consider the juiciest part of the whole thing?
I have not seen it, so I'm dying to.
I have read that part in a workshop.
And you like that last part?
Oh,
the last part.
I really like
that. You've got to
come
just to hear that part.
But. Did it get you, did you feel like more in touch with yourself, more in touch with your femininity, more?
Absolutely. I have to admit that in some cases when we were first doing it, I was almost embarrassed to say some of the words out loud.
Hmm.
And in essence, when we were reading, you know, we read the whole script together because it's a story. But when we start performing it and we start really talking about things, they really touch you, because it takes all aspects of the female kaleidoscope of people. We've got different ways that they address their vagina, the way they talk about it.
What you call down there? That is
down
the
there.
Cutest bit.
Oh yeah, well I do that one.
You
the
do
down
that one
there,
too.
Yes,
okay.
I do the 72-year-old lady.
And I'm sure that guys go through the same thing about
the penis chronicles.
Yeah. Well, what you call down there, it's what it usually is.
Yeah. And there's a whole section where we just go with all the names that are present.
Yes.
And there's something like 50 different names in different areas that call their what they call their vagina. And I have to admit, a lot of it is funny for the cast. Even us doing it and we're performing, we still break up doing
for the intent of this play, it's names for the vagina. It really isn't just the vagina.
No,
it's the whole sexual apparatus, I guess you would say.
Absolutely.
Of that women have, and there is, you know, one that they come up with that I think is
shocking and provocative.
Ooh, and titillating.
Yes, and
yes,
that too.
Yes, yes, and it will start with the premiere benefit performance Thursday.
Yes,
at
this
the
coming
Montrose
Thursday,
Counseling
Montrose
Center,
Counseling Center,
401 Brannard,
the old fitness exchange,
and there is a special rate for since it is a benefit.
Yes,
and then
yes.
The regular performances will be Friday and Saturday nights, starting
with May 9th through the 31st of May.
So the month of May, basically.
Basically,
Friday.
The
very
month of
month
May.
Of May.
Yes.
Starting, you know, this Friday. Set it up. Make the phone call. Be sure to call for reservations to 713-522-2204. And come out. It is it's great fun. You're going to laugh. You're going to cry. You're going to go through a whole gambit of emotions in an hour and a half.
And even if you're vagina phobic,
reason.
Exactly.
Absolutely.
Come and expand your horizons.
Yeah. Oh, gosh. Yeah. Absolutely.
Well, Jennifer, is there a certain character name for this character?
Well, this character is the woman who loved to make vaginas happy.
Well,
yes,
you
yes. I got cast in that. I don't know why, but Joe thought it was fit.
Somehow fitting. Okay, well, tell us about the woman who loved to make vaginas
She was an average woman, but she never found the kind of comfort she did with men. And she discovered how much she really enjoyed making women happy. And she became obsessed with it, and she became a sex worker. She was a dominatrix, but she only dominated women and satisfied women.
Well, tell us her story.
How about
in her own words.
In her own words, the very first part. How about that? Go save the best for last. I love vaginas. I love women. I do not see them as separate things. Women pay me to dominate them, to excite them, to make them come. I did not start out like this, no. On the contrary, I started out as a lawyer. But in my late 30s, I became obsessed with making women happy. There were so many unfulfilled women, so many women who had no access to their sexual happiness. It began as a mission of sorts, but then I got involved in it. I got very good at it, kind of brilliant. It was my art. I started getting paid for it. It was as if I'd found my calling. I wore outrageous outfits when I dominated women. Lace and silk and leather. I used props, whips and handcuffs and rope. There was nothing like this in tax law. There are no props, no excitement. And I hated those blue corporate suits. Although I'd wear them from time to time in my new line of work, and they serve me quite nicely. Context is everything. There are no props in corporate law. No wetness, no dark, mysterious floor play. No erect nipples, no delicious mouths. But mainly, there's no moaning. Not the kind I'm talking about, anyway.
Very good.
Yeah, there are some moaning in tax laws, but not that kind.
That was an excerpt by our wonderful Jennifer Renee.
Yes.
Thank you very much.
To hear the rest of that wonderful speech, you'll have to go
It goes on. Actually, that was, about 2 minutes? It goes on for another 7 minutes.
I don't think I could handle it.
You'll have to come and see the play for the rest of the story.
Yeah.
And the twist at the end, I'm dying to hear.
The twist at the end. Oh, absolutely. There is a twist at the end.
I've heard that. So.
Well, that's The Vagina Monologues with a Unique Twist.
Absolutely.
By Theater New West. For reservations, call 713-522-2204. And thank you, Jennifer Renee, for being with us on Queer Voices.
I played with my Barbie when I was a kid. It sure was the most fun thing that I ever did. But when Daddy found out, boy, he flipped his lid. I should have been born a girl. My Daddy, he said, are you my daughter or son? And I said, oh, Daddy, do I have to pick one? Then I'll be your daughter. It's so much more fun. I should have been born a girl. You have to understand I have a feminine side. And feeling soft and pretty isn't something to hide. I like wearing makeup. It covers my flaws. I go get a facial to close up my pores. I dress as a woman, I do it because I should have been born a girl. Although I'm a fella, I carry a purse. I don't get my period, but something much worse. Too much testosterone is really the curse. I should have been born a girl. So who am I? I often sit and wonder, did nature make a terrible blunder? I just got a letter, I read it, and wow, I've just been accepted as a member of NOW. Although I'm a fella, I joined anyhow. I should have been born a girl. Well, I think I have the answer, so that when I get home, I'll look through all the want ads for an X chromosome. I'd love to be female, think I'll give it a whirl. I should have been born a girl.
Well, I'm sure glad I was born a girl.
Well, I'm glad I'm one now.
I'm still a guy, and I'm kind of I'm
okay with that. You're okay with
you're okay with that. Hey, that's okay.
Yeah.
Hey, just a quickie. This Wednesday is the Houston GLBT Political Caucus General Meeting. It's over at Haven Center, there on West Alabama, right next to the Chocolate Bar, and between the Chocolate Bar and St. Stephen's Church. There's a reception at 6:30, and the meeting starts promptly at 7.
Is there a particular program?
This week, we're going, this month, we'll have Jolanda Jones, James Rodriguez, and Wanda Adams will be there. Those are the three we worked for. Our community and the caucus worked very hard to get elected to city council, and they want to come back and talk to us, tell us what's going on, and thank us for their help.
And, Brian, you wanted to remind folks that Thursday...
Yes, this Thursday is the Act Out at Alley Theater. That's their kind of their GLBT night, and it's the performance of An American in Paris.
It's the largest production they've ever done,
I didn't
know that. It's bound to be fabulous. It's supposed to be what took place backstage or in the background during the filming of the movie.
I'm very excited.
Yeah, I got
tickets.
And they give you a reception.
The performance, there's a reception.
Yeah.
That's always a fun social.
So call the Alley Theater.
That's right.
And don't
forget about the vagina monologues.
Yes. And thanks very much to David Elliott for joining us, as he does every first Monday of the month, to Abel Rodriguez with Gallo, telling us about what's going on in the Houston Hispanic GLBT community.
We'd like to thank Daddy Bob, Miss Christy, and Sir Robert of the Leather community, who are filling us in about that portion of our community.
And of course... the lovely Jennifer Renee for telling us about the vagina monologues. And thank you to Brian E. for being our engineer tonight.
Good job, Brian.
Yeah, filling in for Glenn, who's in Canada. And
who should be listening right now.
Blame it on Canada.
Yeah, we will be preempted for 2 weeks. We will be having fun drive and specials from the KPFT archives. So do... tune in, and then we'll be back with you the 20-something.
Would it not be the 26th? 3 weeks
something like that.
Something like that.
Yeah.
But come back and join us. We'll miss you. I hope you'll miss us.
Thank you very much.
Been listening to Queer Voices, heard each Monday at 8 p.m. here on KPFT, a publicly funded Pacifica Network station. Queer Voices is produced live in Houston with recorded segments from This Way Out, which is produced at KPFK in Los Angeles. Queer Voices executive producer is Jack Walensky. On air voices are Glenn Holt, J.D. Doyle, Deborah Bell, Jennifer Renee, Greg Chapman, and Jack Walensky. Be sure to listen every Saturday night, Sunday morning at 1 a.m. for After Hours with Jimmy Carper. It's Queer Radio with Attitude. This is listener-sponsored and commercial-free Pacifica Radio, KPFT, at 90.1 FM, 89.5 FM Galveston, and worldwide via streaming audio from kpft.org.
On May 17th, the Progressive Forum hosts a benefit concert for KPFT featuring satirical singer-songwriter Roy Zimmerman, who writes the funniest songs about the war on terror, the NSA tapping your phone, stolen elections, neoconservatives, and more.
What do you call a tax cut for the wealthiest 1%?
Homeland Security.
What do you call the other 99 who can't make the rent?
Homeland Security.
A lovely little bit of phraseology for all the neocon men when they announce a massive deficit. Something that they can say to preface it.
Have fun and support KPFT by coming out to hear Roy Zimmerman May 17th, 8 p.m. at The Artery at Jackson and Prospect. Tickets are $15. For more information, go to kpft.org or call 713-526-4000. This is KPFT, Houston.
Welcome to Sprouts, radio from the grassroots, a weekly program that showcases stories.
The free program you just heard was paid for by the listener members of KPFT Houston. If you're not already a KPFT member, we encourage you to join with us in keeping free speech alive by becoming one. Basic membership is still $35 a year. You don't have to, but you'll feel better. Thanks for listening.